everyone. How are you?
Hello.
Good weekend so far?
Yes.
Awesome. That's what we like to hear. We, me, I'm here alone today. That's what I like to hear. No third person here. We are designing a game today. We are going to be going through the process of designing a game, or at least the skeleton of a game, from start to finish. And the purpose of this is that I have, over the years that I've made games, I've had to talk through a lot of people, what have you. I get bored to hell with lectures. I don't like them. It's not my thing. I don't really like doing them. I can be verbose at times. I can be chatty at times. Don't really do the lectures very much. So, instead of that, instead of the lecture process, what I'm going to do is I'm going to take you guys through the process. I'm going to force you guys to make things. And in doing so, I will occasionally butt in, give you anecdotes, tell you a little bit about things, and pose challenges that will make the process a little bit harder and make you guys overcome it. I figure that in practice, in doing, we will be able to communicate the fundamental parts of design a little bit better. So, I'm going to go over a little bit of Design 101, but I'm not actually going to tell you about it. We're going to do it. And then I'll break in, as I said, with anecdotes. I've made a lot of games, I've made a lot of mistakes, I've made a lot of successes over the years, and I'll share that with you. I'm just not going to do it in the traditional format. My name, David A. Hill Jr. I am a freelance writer, a developer, an indie publisher. I have worked for White Wolf, Paizo, Green Ronin, Catalyst, a lot of the major game publishers, pretty much at least half of the bigger names out there I've done work for at times. I also own my own company, Machine Age Productions. We are purveyors of fine games. You can find us at booth 1356, and you should come say hi. Don't be a stranger afterwards. If you have questions, I would love to handle them, particularly if they are very specific in nature. While I will answer questions at the end, if it is like very, very specific to you and your design goals, come to me afterwards, talk to me, and I will love to talk to you, but I don't want to waste everyone's time with something that only concerns you. I think that's pretty much that for the introductions. We've done this a number of times. Every time we do it, it's a little bit different, because we're making a game, and every time there's different people involved. So we have different sensibilities, different personalities, different interests, and so there's going to be a different game. We're going to handle it what I like to call semi-democratically, which is to say that whenever something comes up, I'll sort of eyeball, show hands, or ask opinions or what have you. I will act as the developer in this capacity. By developer, in this case, I mean that I will make you guys do all of the work, and I will take all the credit. The inside thing. But basically, I'm going to make you guys work. That is my goal. I'm going to make you guys accomplish, and I'm going to pose challenges. So, the first big consideration that I always tell people whenever they are looking to make a game is that you have to have a clear vision in mind. You have to have a clear sort of statement of intent. You got to figure out what you're trying to do. The statement of intent when I design games is very, very clear. I try to make it a single sentence that I can use as my acid test for any decision that I have to make. If I say that I am making a game about anthropomorphic oranges, then at any point where I reach a crossroads and I have to make a choice between point A and point B, I'm going to pick the one that is closer to anthropomorphic oranges. Stick closer to your vision. In this case, what we're going to do is we're going to start a work through the game. Once we get probably about 3/4 to complete in the process, I'm going to have people talk about potential mission statements, vision statements. You're going to come up with a declarative sentence that is going to help us make further decisions. Because clearly, while we are making a game today, we are not making a fully fleshed out game. So if you wanted to take the notes home and you wanted to flesh it out and make something else of it, that would be the statement that you would want to use in order to make your game more communicative, a more clear representation of what the design goals were. So, as I say that, keep that in the back of your mind. As we're talking, I want you to consider what that potential sentence might be, what that statement might be, what your vision, what your mission is going to be. So, the first real step, because that's sort of a thinking step, that's what we call hippie design. The first real thing that we're going to do, though, is come up with the sort of genre, the type of game that we are going to make. I'm going to take a couple of suggestions, and just things that maybe you haven't seen in games, or you haven't seen done correctly in games, what have you. We're going to filter it down, we're going to take about three, and then we're going to decide. We're going to vote on which one that we like, and which one we're going to proceed with. This is sort of the cutting room floor, this step. So, what kind of game would you like to make? Back there.
Heroic psychodrama, stuff that's about the interiority of heroism, not just the external needs.
So, psychoanalyzing heroism. Yeah. Sort of taking a sort of cerebral approach to the idea.
Yeah, the action stuff is there, but it's about what's going on inside the hero, what happens, the difficult decisions to get made.
So we're just dissecting the decision-making in heroic stories, basically.
Yeah, but mixing with the action as well. Like,
Yeah. I mean, we're still doing it, but then we're taking an analytical approach. Yeah. Okay, analytical approach to heroism. Second suggestion, right there.
Victorian fantasy, not like steampunk, but Victorian fantasy.
Fantasy. Okay, Victorian fantasy. There is a second setup. Third.
Interiority for like transitions. Like, what does it really mean to be a werewolf for like that your gender changed or something?
Okay, more analytical, but in a general sense or specific? Because you're mentioning a couple of things here.
Shit, I don't know. Let's go with general.
Okay, a more general analytical approach to decision-making and what it means to do weird things that happen in games. Okay, another one.
A slightly more symbolic approach with a large-than-life focus on events that aren't quite as... not quite the level of micromanagement of a lot of tabletop games, but more of an emphasis on... I really can't think of a better term for it than symbolic.
Okay, so as Dan Brown would incorrectly have it, symbology. Any more suggestions? We have four.
Starfighters, like Star Wars or Wing Commander.
Okay, so Starfighting. Okay, we have five suggestions. So what we have here, and just to dissect, because my notebook is non-existent, we have the analytical approach to heroism. We have the analytical general approach, looking at that sort of thing. We have the symbolism approach. We're looking at very specific Victorian fantasy, and we're looking at very specific starfighting. Notebook. It's actually not necessary. I have a pretty good memory as long as we don't exceed like six or seven things.
Okay, I didn't have my paper or not.
Yeah, no, we're cool. Thank you. It's not a big deal. And besides, you guys will hold me accountable. Do you have a question or another suggestion? I will take another suggestion.
Another suggestion.
Sure.
It kind of ties into the various analytical approaches, but more tracking decision-making and growth of your character as in your character's personality as opposed to your character's stats and things like that.
I think that's a specific approach that sort of looks at, or that is, that proposes an approach to the game itself. And I think that could accomplish anything that those two were talking about. That is a way to filter down and communicate those things. So I think we're really still looking at about five different things. So, show of hands. First off, we're going to look at the analytical approach to heroism. Okay. And you can raise your hand more than once. It's not a big deal. If you like it, raise. So then we go Victoriana fantasy. Okay. All right. Next, we have
the analytical approach to general role-playing game stuff, weird crap that happens in the world, how we would look at that. Okay. Starfighter space fantasy thing. Okay. And we've got, what's the one I forgot?
Symbology.
Okay. So we have about an equal one in the Victorian, and we had an equal one in the other two, the two analytical ones. So I'm going to do one more time with them, real quick. So we'll start out with the Victorian. Okay. 13, unlucky. And so now we're going to go analytical general. Okay, a couple fewer that time. Analytical heroism. Okay, going to go for Victorian here. That's 13. It's things that I would like to explore get cut, but that happens. That is a part of the process. Unfortunately, ideas are a dime a dozen. Being able to explore them is a little bit less feasible. So, we will try to do a Victorian fantasy game throughout this process. The first question is, what are we trying to accomplish with this? What are we gonna? Are we gonna answer questions? Are we going to? Are we going to actually take an analytical approach to this? Because we can always compromise. Are we going to say screw analysis? We're stabbing shit. Are we going to answer the question of class warfare or what have you? Let's come up with about three, four so ideas for things that we want to address with this game, things that we want to accomplish, because this is really important.
I mean, if you're going to do a Victoriana kind of game, you need them. I mean, you could go with just a Victorian aesthetic, but mm-hmm. it seems almost pointless to do Victoriana if you're not going to address, like, major class issues and concepts of morality and things like that to define the Victorian era. If it's just petticoats and
taking a more cultural approach as opposed to an aesthetic approach. Yeah. So we're really tackling what that period means, comparing it to today, of course, because that's RPGs.
Well, the term Victorian era kind of brings to mind an urban setting, but I think you can expand to the kind of conception of the world in the Victorian era and how stuff was regarded and how things were related between, say, Europe and the parts of Africa and the tone that you had around that time.
Okay, so looking at a more broader, like a world approach, what it means, what the era means.
My thought was Victorian fantasy would be in the same, analyzed in the same way that Tolkien did World War II fantasy, focusing on the issues of the Victorian era, the social issues, the cultural norms, etc., and then using fantasy as a
metaphor.
For those.
Okay, so a metaphorical approach.
Yes.
Perhaps we could accentuate the social issues by using more of an alternative history.
Emphasizing or de-emphasizing things in order to approach. That would be a very specific approach to basically what they were talking about. So I think, yeah, that more filters it down. In a game, that's what we do. We emphasize things and we run filters and we try to heighten the experience of certain things. That's why in our Renaissance games, people are not covered in shit. It's just not what we do. Other suggestions?
How about the Victorian era was known for exploring the unknown.
That's a good one.
Lots of great things to explore during that time period.
Awesome.
If we do a mystery horror, Sherlock Holmes meets Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, but he's an elf.
Awesome. One more suggestion.
Not just exploring the unknown, but also that whole imperial dynamic. Once you explore it, then they won't.
Yes.
And the reaction, the thing about that is that if we're taking a fantasy approach, then that means that all of the local fantasy entities may have something to say about this idea. So the idea that we have these Victorian, like, steam-driven cultures going out and taking over the world, or trying to, and meeting, you know, the celestial dragons, that kind of stuff. So if we're going high fantasy, we'd actually get really colourful there.
Okay. So we've got some really good suggestions here, because this is the earlier part. Getting into deep discussion about that will probably take more time than we want. So I'm going to go over. I'm going to do another vote, and then we'll start discussing the next parts. We have an approach where we're looking at the class system, the traditions. The ideals of the Victorian. Yes.
So I actually see that as very compatible. Like, you have.
I do, actually. I agree with you.
I'm not sure anything here is incompatible. It all seems like it fits together pretty well.
I know, but for the. And you were totally correct that we could do that. The reason why I'm going to try to filter it down is because we have an hour and we want to make a sort of focused game. Mm-hmm. It'll help us with our design goals if we keep things tight. For the purpose of this exercise. So, approaching the classism, approaching the traditions of the time, do we want to take that angle? Hands up. Okay. Do we want to approach the spirit of exploration? Okay, that pretty much wins. So, like, there's not a way that we can beat that. So, We can use the other elements. We can most certainly draw from them. But we want to keep in mind that ultimately we are sort of focusing on the Victorian spirit of exploration. That's a wonderful way to explore those other topics. But just in the hierarchy of importance in what we are doing, we're just going to keep that one at the top for now. That's all. Yes, Jason.
Might I propose, rather than the spirit of exploration, the spirit of colonization? And bringing civilization?
Yes. In the specific language, I think that the spirit of colonization is really what we're talking about here. Because if you say that the Victorians were anything different than that, then basically you're cheating yourself. I think we're really talking about the spirit of imperialism and colonization. So that's what we've got. Who are we playing? Now, I know in some games you can play whatever you want, blah, 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 sandbox and this and this. But I think that we need to talk about who we're playing because of the focus. Yes?
An exploratory crew, or the first sort of imperial expedition to mm-hmm. the area, will be made up of a huge number of different classes, which ties into the class thing, mm-hmm. and allows for like British local folk traditions, leprechauns or pixies or whatever, to actually come with the crew almost like rats.
Yeah.
Spirits are being explored from different crew.
So you're sort of dragging it along.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Okay, so exploratory crew, this is a very broad thing, but it's also very iconic for what we're talking about, the safari, the expedition.
One idea is, was...
Sorry, can you speak up just a touch?
Taking it from the viewpoint of the monsters, the people that are being colonized. So
okay.
The British encroachment rather than playing the British.
The opposite end of that. And the challenge that I will pose to you in that, because I was thinking the same thing, it was kind of mulling over in my head, do you play the monsters that are being colonized, or are the monsters colonizing you? Because oftentimes you'll see, like, Tolkien is probably the prime example, the outsider element is always, like, the dark-skinned orcs. Do we approach that, or do we challenge it?
I prefer... Sorry.
Cherokee,
I prefer to challenge it.
I think that would be a fun approach.
Whites, I prefer, to challenge it.
I think that's a pretty cool idea. You've got more, though, right?
To what you were saying about to have the local traditions, so the local British folklore...
Mm-hmm.
And to tie it in with colonization, it might be going a little bit far for us, but they could also become invasive species.
That would be cool. And
Sometimes we will go far, and that's cool. That's okay, because posing the idea is always going to be a positive thing in these cases.
I think part of the answer to this question depends on what kind of scope we want for this game.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's a very large scope game, and the larger part of that usually is mobility.
Yes.
And they'll take them to a variety of different locations. That could change how we want to approach the characters.
Absolutely. That's a good question. Jason?
One idea, I was thinking about the... quite frankly, who wasn't thinking about playing the locals faced with the imperialists? But my thought was, what about the native peoples who are the translators, the peacemakers, the interrogators between the explorers, the middle ground who are stuck between a rock and a hard place, which focuses down the natives? Otherwise, you could play anyone in all of the native nations.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Or you could just say there's one, whatever. You could filter it down however you want it. But I think really what we're talking about now is three basic approaches. We can funnel them, we can filter them, but we're really looking at one side, the other, or the middle. Okay. And we can sort of wax philosophical about how we're going to approach either one as we get to it. But let's just try to determine which one we're going to go with first. So, do we want to play the imperialists? No, we don't really want to play the imperialists. I'm done with that. Do we want to play the invaded? Okay. Do we want to play the middle ground? Middle ground it is. All right. So the middle ground. And that actually, I think that opens it up because you could literally be playing either side because you're going to have that element on coming from either direction. So while keeping it focused, we are also opening it up. We are giving more opportunity. More opportunity is usually a good thing. But what games really are is structure. They're rules. They're things to prevent you from doing things. They add walls. And those walls help you be creative. If you are given elements and you are told to work with them, you will be far more creative than if you are given a blank piece of paper. Otherwise, we wouldn't need games. We would just use blank pieces of paper. That is good. So, middle ground it is. We are the centrists. We are the people that are preventing everything from going awry. Quite a noble pursuit, actually. Depends on why you're doing it, I guess. But, the next question is, we have to have a core sort of conflict. We have to have something that is approaching us that is the real main problem, the thing that is always on our minds. We always have side antagonists and stuff, but really, what is the problem that we are trying to address?
Choosing the side. Choosing which side to help. You're in the middle ground, you see both sides, you can see from both sides' perspective, but really, what's the right thing to do for you morally on both sides? If you're in the...
Let me sort of expound upon that for just a second. I think that that's definitely important to what we're talking about. I think that there's two directions we can take that. The first direction would be moral gray area, where either side has its pros and cons, where you could actually look at either side as being noble or being savage. That is typically the way that most modern history books approach that period. The other hand would be, instead of moral gray area, is a sort of stated black and white, which I think is sort of underemphasized in modern games a lot of the times. We could say that one side is sort of good and one side is sort of bad, and that maybe there's an incentive for going for the bad. Continue.
I don't want to take over, but...
No, please! We're talking!
I like the gray area.
Okay.
They're not gray, but they're good and bad on both sides.
Yeah.
But...
Oh, sorry.
The pressure, the reason you have to choose
mm-hmm.
is because soon it's time sensitive, so... One side's gonna win eventually. So
okay. So we have our problem is the clock.
It's gonna come to a head.
Yeah.
And you're part of it.
Okay.
I think the moral gray area introduces like an additional level of complexity.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if that's what we want to do or not. We should think about
that. That's the question. Yeah, that's really what I'm thinking. Because there's nothing wrong with an unapologetically simpler game. We just have to acknowledge it from the forefront.
Well, getting into with the time pressure thing, you know, the coming century change,
mm-hmm.
that's a big fear during
yeah.
Victorian time, and that can be emphasized a lot with the coming of, you know, the ancient ones, the spirits, the, you know, the opening of the fairy gate,
which
like that.
Could be a metaphor for industrialization and
mm-hmm.
stuff. Yeah, absolutely. Thoughts?
Running off of both of those ideas, I feel like you guys are here, but going off of the gray area and going off of the upcoming like century turn, something big event happening,
mm-hmm.
kingdom come. The imperialists are waiting for the rest of their nation to fill in, to really just, okay, we laid the ground, now we take over.
Mm-hmm.
The middle grounds know that this is coming, and they want there to be a balance, but there isn't yet.
Okay, in the back there?
It just seems like you need... I don't know, it almost seems like what you're trying to do as the middleman is keep the peace. So you've got something like, you know, the slave, you know, the conqueror ready to rebel while you're trying not to bring war from one side and rebellion from the other. Maybe even something, if we're doing the fantasy thing, something like maybe the, you know, encroaching creatures are wiping out the ones that are trying to keep the remaining species alive while not angering the conquerors.
I think that at this point we basically, it sounds like we more or less agree that the conflict is really in the prevention or the otherwise intervention into a larger conflict. Ultimately, that's what we're all communicating. So let's just talk a little bit and approach the gray area versus the black and white area. Because there are pros and cons. Does someone have a couple of pros for the black and white?
I feel that if we approach the black and white spectrum, I'm more for the gray, but to play devil's advocate, we can really keep it simple. We can play off the sort of spirit of exploration and all the things that we have set up so far by going... These guys are clearly in it just to take over. Or maybe the savages are here just... Well, not the savages, but the natives are
here.
The
proverbial savages.
Yeah, the proverbial savages, thank you, are here. Maybe they're there just to perverse the imperialization. Maybe they're there just to be malicious and get in the way.
It'd be a neat approach. Thinking about the simple, you know, the simple approach... I don't know that it's necessarily that simple. I think that there's a lot of complexity in having to make the hard choice. Sometimes it's hard to go with the bad guy. Sometimes it's better for your family to go with the bad guy. And sometimes you legitimately think that the other side is wrong. That everything that you stand for is not being represented. And there's a lot of complexity in that. So, some more thoughts?
Kind of spinning off what you were just talking about, the black and white approach really forces you to make a choice and stick with that choice, whereas if you're taking the roguish gray route, you kind of drift back and forth and whatever kind of suits your needs. But if you're really forced to say, okay, I need to do A, I need to stick with A, then it's extremely, very streamlined.
Okay, back there?
And just, as a whole, players like black and white. They like to go and kill the bad guys and get the loot, not have to feel bad about the bad guys' little babies waiting at home with them. They don't want to care about that. They want a black and white game.
Okay, let's, cons for the black and white.
I see this as a false dichotomy, because gray is built out of black and white.
Yeah.
Individual issues are black and white. This is taboo. This is not taboo. Which, on a greater scale, means you've got a lot of gray.
The question, though, honestly, whenever you talk about... Whenever you're actually talking about black and white issues, I do know what you're saying. You're totally correct in that it is sort of a false dichotomy. But the question is, are your characters approaching from a black and white? Do they perceive certain things as right and wrong? Do we assume a setting can see? Do we say that our characters inherently have a set of beliefs? Some more thoughts? Yeah.
Yeah, this may be a bit premature, but I think also the black and white versus the gray issue, it's going to manifest in terms of the game mechanically, because mm-hmm. black and white is easier to express in terms of actual mechanics, whereas gray makes for better role-playing. So is this a game that's more focused on rules interaction, or a game more focused on role-playing?
Good thinking. We will actually approach mechanics near the end, which is fine, but it's definitely something to consider now. I think to an extent you are right, but on the other hand, you can also flip that on its head. Because if you take a black and white approach, you can use the mechanics to add a depth to black and white. Black and white is a hard choice. Hard choices are what games are about. You can do black and white as a hard choice or black and white as a soft choice. You can walk in and kill everyone and not care about their babies. Or you can actually lament on having to do the wrong thing. Did you have some thoughts?
Feel like gray gives more a variety of adventure types.
Mm-hmm. It definitely does.
Whereas you could, you know, as a game master, you could have one time, you know, you need to, you know, perhaps, you know, save this idol from the imperialists, you know, facing it. And then the next time, you know, the imperialists are just doing something, and there's a, you know, some of the natives are mistakenly against it, although it will actually help them in the long run.
Okay, back in the back.
This is actually quite an interesting, but the question of gray versus black and white is something that shifts over time. What is the business of keeping the pace right now?
Mm-hmm.
If the overall bigger picture is trending in a particular way, it may actually result in preventing resistance or preventing it from that then change.
Mm-hmm.
The business of sort of what you could actually do is say, okay, well, you can be black and white, or you can be gray, you can try and keep the balance, and all of those things are equally problematic.
Yes.
So there's whether or not the characters believe that the world is black and white mechanically, the setting can provide that contrast, and then you let the characters work out for themselves where they think they stand. And then somehow build into it that each of those things is, with the passage of time in the setting, each of those positions has its own problems.
I totally agree. Really, this is one of those situations where I was just posing sort of challenges to see how you guys would overcome it and to make you guys think about what you're approaching. I think that honestly, you've just filtered it down what we're talking about. And I think that taking a slightly abstracted approach to it is probably a good thing. Letting it sort itself out and approaching everything on a case-for-case basis. That's a strong way to look at it. But really, again, keep these considerations in the back of your mind as we're developing on. The next question is, what's the currency? Not necessarily money, but what's the thing that people want? Like the default answer is land. But let's stretch. Let's explore a couple of other ideas. What other things do the people in the game setting want? What drives plot?
Social norms. They want to control the social norms of what this land will be after the turn of the century.
Okay. Social norms, that's definitely a currency.
Totally magic. It's fantasy. This magic
battle. Magic.
People gotta get it.
Magic as allegory or just magic?
Oh shit.
Is it a resource?
A resource. A limited resource, which is the reason for imperialism. So, allegory.
Okay, there we go. Magic as allegory. Next.
Fame.
Fame.
Seriously, I'm the first to discover this. I found this magical vein. I found these native peoples. I am the one who did this.
So literally, exploration as the currency, and less than the land, but more of the recognition, the accomplishment.
Yes.
Back in the back.
That kind of goes close to saying influence.
Influence. That is a good one. In the gray shirt, Rick, you had your hand up.
I was going to go with some sort of actual physical resource, a power node that drives them to be there in the first place.
Okay, a physical resource, mining or whatever.
What if a so-called clash of mythos
of the new world meeting old world could be potentially disastrous or unpredictable, kind of like pushing the crystal into the mass spectrometer kind of thing. No one knows really what will happen.
Is that something that someone wants, though? Because really, we're talking about want. Because plot is driven by want.
By being the one to maybe possibly control or drive these new developments.
So basically, we're talking about advancement. Advancement as currency.
I would say information, not just mapping the world, but also keeping updates on what's going on.
Information.
And colonization goes with that, keeping track of what your quote-unquote citizens are up to.
Going on the magic idea, when he mentioned the leprechauns and the stuff tagging along, the magic as a resource, perhaps that's why they're tagging along. Maybe it's depleted back in the other place, and they have to survive.
Kind of also combining some of the things that have already been said, but with social norms and magic, but source of magic in terms of the Victorians being a church-driven source versus the shamans of
sort of the monotheistic versus polytheistic magic.
Yeah.
Awesome.
So there's still the magic to collect, but who controls it and how?
Yeah, which is the dominating force of magic?
Sort of a similar vein on several folks is. Magic is the source because it is gateways to those fantasy fairy realms, the where all the mythos comes from, and they are fixed gateways that people are discovering.
Yeah, what we're talking about in that case is actually, that's another magic is allegory, because what we're talking about is access.
Yes.
Access is a perfect currency. Back there?
Kind of going a little bit more in depth, but it fits with the Victorian theme to do ley lines and ley points for individuals.
That would probably be considered a resource. Like just thinking about it like that. Yes.
If you bring it into territory and travel, you can, like my lands, there's certain conditions where you can actually travel alone. Mm-hmm. And that gets into the whole
access. Yeah, transport.
The other thing very quickly was to tie to the point about magic coming from control of social norms. Mm-hmm. So you have some inherent power in Christian faith or polytheism or animism or whatever the belief system is, but you would get additional power from getting people to believe you and to go along with your ritual.
Belief.
Exactly.
Belief is definitely
but one of the things that you want to do to symbolize your status or to symbolize your control is control of land or particular places or
Okay, so
I'm going to try to filter it down. We've got a really cool list here. And again, this is one of those things where all of them can be used. But we're going to try to focus on one for the purposes of our game here, our setting. We're really going to try to filter that. So, first off, we're going to go for belief, religion. Hands up.
Okay, societal norms, culture. Actual resource, like mining, that kind of thing.
Straight up magic. Access. Access. I think access, travel. Also, information is the last one.
That's a really hard one. So, yeah, okay. So, access, I think, is really it. Access, the ability to transport, the ability to get to new places. Availability is definitely a strong motivator.
Fame.
Yeah, that, I think that actually kind of goes in with the societal norms a little bit. That's why I included it. Fame is specific. Fame of exploration. Okay. It's cool.
It's a good one, and it's certainly something that I see there. But again, just go with the specifics.
All right, so access. This could be transport. This could actually include things like information and stuff, too. But really, we're talking about land. We're talking about moving on. We're talking about forcing outward and sort of consuming. Is there? And okay, we talked about magic as allegory. I think that's one thing that we can consider separately. Do we do that? Are we going to use magic as an allegory?
This is just a yes or no. Yes.
No. We're going to use magic as an allegory. The easy one, I think the easiest one that we've heard so far is ley lines. Just yes or no, because I think that that's a simple one to vote on. Yes? No? I think that works. There are locations that have special places that can help you travel, communicate, get shit, have superpowers, whatever. So magic is allegory. There's special, special stuff in certain places. And it just happens to be that other people are in those places and you don't want them to be. Or you want them to be on your side, as the case may be. So we have a currency. We have a basic conflict. We have our protagonists. Who are our antagonists?
Extremists on the two sides. Not the sensible people, but the extreme imperialists and the extreme xenophobes.
Cool. Okay. But?
Yes, but also not just as humans, also as like the chief spirits of whatever pantheon.
So we take it and then we make it bigger. That's a perfectly viable thing to do in games. Other suggestions for antagonists? Yes?
Just plain hazards of the environment, wildlife, and things like that.
That's a strong one.
Well, since we're focusing on magic and magic as an access point, maybe something that is coming from the outside, something weakening. Because, like, if you're traveling back and forth through the realm, you open up a hole too many times. All of a sudden, you're letting stuff in from other planes. So maybe, like, other planar kind of stuff.
So a third thing.
Yeah.
Yeah. A third thing is perfectly viable. Now, question just for you because you posed the idea. Is this, in a metaphorical sense, is this thing, this third thing, is it an actual thing with a personality and an identity, or is it a concept? Is it a lack of access?
I really think you can do it either way.
Okay.
Maybe both at the same time. The idea that, you know, this other realm is encroaching along with all its inhabitants.
Another thought?
To follow that up, maybe it's not necessarily an entity. It's like it's a faceless sort of mindless corruption that hits the people that use these access points heavily.
It's a consequence.
Yeah. Like.
So our antagonist is a consequence.
Yeah.
I like the consequence concept idea. Something like, whatever it is on a clock. Maybe it is the clock.
I was just going to say the exact same thing, actually. The idea that maybe when you use this stuff too much, you start to degrade reality. You start to...
So maybe the colonists are coming in and they're trying to invade, not necessarily because they need it, but because if they don't get to it, it's going to be used up. It is effectively a limited resource, and if you don't get in there quick, clearly the people that don't deserve it are going to use it. Jason?
Rebellion and revolution. In the coming of the new century...
Revolution is a good antagonist.
And that will upset all of the norms, all of the cultures, both of the imperialists and of the locals.
Okay.
And
take one more thought.
To go with the magic as an allegory, addiction.
Addiction.
So the use of it is addictive, it has prices to pay, and as he said, it corrupts. So the people that are addicted to it are the real antagonists that are driving all of the conflict.
So you're sort of playing a market filter.
And you have the choice of using it, becoming addicted yourself.
Yeah. Okay. So for primary antagonism, what I'm going to do is I'm going to, first off, I'm going to show of hands for internal or external, because we have the sort of internal the arguments, that would be the addiction and the compulsion, that sort of thing. On the external, we literally have extremists. We have otherworldly creatures, that sort of thing. So is our main antagonist going to be internal? External. Okay. One more time. Internal. External. I think that we can take a dual natured approach here. That's good. No, that's good. That's absolutely good. Nothing wrong with that whatsoever. Yeah.
we were talking about consequences, so the consequence of using it, the internal nature creates an external.
Yep.
Out of nothing.
Yep. That's exactly where I was going with that. Good. Good. So, the internal, we have this compulsion, this addiction, this need for something that we don't have, which is what imperialism is. And then the consequence could be something abstract or something specific. Abstract in the sense of the limited resource, the culture shifts, or we've got revolution. We have otherworldly monsters. So I think that's actually, there's three approaches there. We have the abstract consequences. We have the specific consequences that are societal, revolution. And then we have the third party consequence, which is monsters. So, show of hands, abstract. Societal. Monsters. Monsters it is. So, we're going to have a third party in the form of a monster, basically. Why do we care about the monster? Other than that it's going to eat shit. Why do we care? What is cool about the monster? What is going to draw us to tell stories about the monster?
Some of the monsters may affect natives and imperialists alike. And going with that corruption idea, some of them actually are formerly the savages or the imperialists. They have become the monster.
So they are sort of an evolved form, in a sense. They are something else that was us.
Into that.
Okay, back in the back.
They spawn from the user's own psychosis. So their own fear, their own stuff going in the back of their head. So whoever uses it depends on... So if you've got a certain person type, those would spawn certain kinds of monsters depending on their own phobia.
That's really cool. Like sort of a almost Lovecraftian version. Right there.
I was going to go with the, based on the addiction thing, that they have some sort of mind control. The more addicted you are, the more they are able to control you, where they have entire armies of people that
cool.
are in their control.
All right, so they've got an army of junkies.
I was going to say, not even a faced monster so much as the idea of alternate space infringing and changing the nature of reality around these transports. The more
When I talk about putting a face on the monster, I'm not talking in the literal sense. I'm just talking something to make it appealing. And definitely, alternate space is exploring the idea of the alien is definitely a good one.
Well, we were discussing earlier kind of the clash of monotheists and polytheists. This resource that they're depending on could be from Africa, something like that, where in a sense they're actually fueling an old god, a god that the natives have kept hidden, don't talk about the thing, you know, the thing that we cannot speak of, and the outside force is coming in and they're actually aiding it by.
So, I've got a challenge for that. We're talking about moral gray areas, and we're talking about neither side necessarily being right. Doesn't that imply that one side is wrong? Doesn't it inherently give credence to the imperialists?
It could, not necessarily because they're wrong, but because they're uneducated and they don't have the ability to...
Have you ever listened to imperialists?
No, not necessarily uneducated, but, you know, there's a culture gap. They don't understand.
But that, honestly, that reeks of savages, basically, and then you really are... Because, I mean, honestly, we're pretty much... Western people here, so we are going to have sympathy with the person that is going to the uncultured, the uneducated. We don't have to resolve it right now. It's not a big deal. I'm just sort of posing the challenge that I think that might break down the gray area a little for our sensibilities.
Back there. I'm going to go with the one idea that maybe alter that to where it might work a little better with the gray is that. Maybe not so much that they've been not speaking of it, but they've been appeasing it. They've been keeping it sleeping or silent. While the colonists would rather destroy it, they would rather keep it away. So you're still keeping that same. There's two different approaches. Do you work with the monster, or do you destroy it?
I got a pitch. How about there's two monsters? How about we've got an allegorical Judeo-Christian god, and you've got an allegorical, you know, North African god type thing, and they are opposed, and they're both wrong. But their people are just altogether too faithful and or jaded to understand what's actually going on. That's one way to approach that, where we're not sending a bias in one direction. The other would be that once the side that is in possession of the enemy is trying to solve it, like you are saying. They're trying to keep it back, but the imperialists are causing problems by being there. Those definitely, all of those options put a face on an antagonist. They put a face on that other world. And I think that honestly, and you, anyone that disagrees with me can speak up about it, but I think that if we take one of those approaches, where we have a big, big monster, a god of sorts, I think that taking the sort of army of junkies approach that we were talking about over here, I think that those are not only compatible, but complementary. Because you're gonna have that sort of force of excess feeding one side, or feeding the army. Because who really wants to fight in a war? Who wants to be a part of an army? You have to have a motivation, and it usually has to be a pretty strong one. And a lack of education is a sort of lame one. So we have to deal with that every day. So maybe if we approach it from the aspect that we have something on the outside, some artificial force that we have created as game designers that are influencing the forces, then that's a way to sort of take everyone's ideas here. So, gods. Yes or no? Yes? No. We'll do gods. I think that there is some room to compromise and interpret, though. One god or two? One? Two. Two gods. You seem to have a question.
Do we have to limit ourselves to two?
No. When I say two, I don't necessarily mean two. I mean two sides. Neither good nor bad. We're really talking about not a one-sided god thing.
Mm-hmm.
Where the antagonist, the driving problem there, is not on one side. Because that's breaks down the gray area. So we could take opposing sides. And the next question would be then, if we have one side and another side, do we do monotheistic-monotheistic, monotheistic-polytheistic, or polytheistic-polytheistic? So that's three choices. So we go monotheistic versus monotheistic. Two gods in a fight, basically. One monotheistic, one polytheistic. Two polytheistic sides. We're going in the middle. We're going to go one versus the other. That's fine. And even if we do monotheistic, you don't necessarily a monotheistic system isn't necessarily one god per se. It's just one driving force god.
And again, if we're basing this off of, like, say, Earth, we can pull from the cultural norms of various areas. So mm-hmm. The monotheistic European god versus the polytheism of India or the polytheism of the Americas.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, absolutely. And that's why I think, for the purposes of this exercise, in order to keep it kind of simple, we're going to we'll keep it abstract for now. This is something that we could flesh out as we are doing further development. But I definitely agree with you. I think that offering the options would be kind of cool. That really comes down to how heavily you want to sort of like drive sort of meta plot in your game. If you want to name characters and really come up with hard personalities for these gods, then that is definitely a design choice that you can make. That's a little complex for what we're doing, but I like the abstract idea. Back there, thoughts?
What about animism versus ancestor worship?
That would probably be taking different angles to the polytheistic approach, just sort of exploring new ideas with that. Which, again, I think we can do. I think that's definitely something that we could approach with the game. I don't know that we're going to get in that kind of detail today. Hour? Yeah. Okay, cool. So, one more thought.
Well, I'm thinking that what if the if you have the monotheist and the polytheist, if you have too much of one in one area, one focus, that it limits the access to the magical resource, so you have to have the balance.
That would be really cool. Actually, I really like that. Forcing the jerks to work together.
And jerks on either end.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yes, jerks all around. Okay. So, gonna do, because we've got, we're talking about fantasy, and we're talking about a specific time period, and we're talking about imperialism. We've got a lot of really cool general ideas. What I'm gonna do now is we're gonna fire off a couple of ideas, and we're just gonna yay or nay them, as we get them. And what these are is we're just gonna talk about, some ways to clarify and to further expound upon it. Elements. Maybe we have elves, but maybe our elves are flaming elves. I don't know. The thing is, though, we're going to just pitch a couple of setting elements. Just throw some things out. We're brainstorming now. After everything that we brainstorm, keep it simple, too. Keep it to, like, a statement, a sentence. That way we're not debating too much. And then we yay or nay vote. And then we'll just sort of watch the setting evolve. We'll take a couple minutes to brainstorm. So, idea pitches.
The allegory for industry is you feed sweet magic into dragons and they do awesome stuff. Otherwise, the indigenous people do smaller things sort of more personally. Craft magic.
Okay, so we basically, we're dragon food magic. we are looking at the possibility of feeding dragons as the allegory. Yay or nay? Yes?
Me.
You better! Nay. Okay, that's a little on the nay side. Good. Good brainstorming. Next.
The aforementioned junkie drug, if I think we're keeping that in, right?
Yeah.
Comes from the gods.
They make it.
They extrude the drug.
Oh, it's like God sweat.
Yeah.
That's my punk cover band. Okay, see you. All right. The magic drug is God sweat. Yay. Nay. We're right about even there. Let's see. We'll come back to that one and see if it evolves into something else. It is an idea to consider. Next.
The idea of belief as power for the gods, that you want more followers because that directly affects your god's ability to influence the world.
Belief makes superpowers for your gods. Yay or nay? Yay. Nay. Belief is a power here. Okay, belief makes for energy. Next.
Because you're kind of on... You're at a portion where you've got people that are very religious... And you're on the cusp of medical breakthroughs. You've got two different systems of healing.
Ooh, two different systems of healing. Basically, scientific versus sort of cultural or holistic.
Yeah.
Okay, yay or nay? Nay? We're good. We like that. That is a good clash. And definitely representative of what we're talking about.
Same idea, but with transportation. Forces versus trains.
Ooh, okay, so transportation angle. We consider that. Transportation, important element. Yay? Nay. I think that can play into our game. Next.
To go into the... I don't know if we've decided we're keeping the monsters created from psyche and the addiction.
Yes.
But to do that, there's only so much space in everyone's mind. So you've got the bad things that come out. The gods are also the good things. So however much space is taken up, they're also created by...
Oh, the gods are like basically a buffer for the bad shit.
Or they're a collection of everybody's good thoughts societally.
Oh, okay, so the gods are basically sort of a manifestation of culture?
Yeah, so they're both the magic is both manifestations come up.
I think that that's really cool. Gods are manifestation of culture. Yes. No. Gods are manifestation of culture. I dig it. Next suggestion.
The science can be, I guess, powered by magic.
I think, and again, correct me if I'm wrong, I think that that's kind of what we're going for here, because we're talking about the magic as allegory. And really, Victorian is about advancement and moving into industrialization, that sort of thing like that. So I think that magic is really what we're talking about there, right? Like, yeah, yeah. So I think that that's already a part of the setting.
Yeah, we brought in, like, ley lines and stuff, and maybe something like the crossroads of the ley lines are a power quest to travel to the other realms where we keep the different things. So we might have a fairy realm, but you have to reach a node to find it.
I think that that's sort of implied, right?
It's not like there, you know, you walk out into the bush and there's a fairy out there.
Yeah, no, it's definitely tied to that. Because really, we've got to tie our resource and we've got to tie our antagonism to what we're doing, or else you're going to have the antagonist over here and the PCs doing shit over here.
You mentioned that the gods as a reflection of the developed culture.
Mm-hmm.
But would that also take into account, like, the gods developed and evolving in response to the development of technology?
That's a good question. Do the gods sort of evolve with the technology, with the advancement? Yes or no? Yes? No. I think that that's actually a yes. I think that the gods evolve. The gods will develop with time. Back in the back.
But because of that, you could, coming back to the animism thing as well, one of the differences between the gods or the godly beings on one side as opposed to the other might be one's much more, or it's only human, whereas the other is animals, trees, herbs, mountains, like they're actually still much more informed by the natural world and by specific places.
I think that's probably an implication. Because that was the impression that I was getting. But we'll go for a vote on that one. So the gods on one end are more human, and then on the other end are more natural, more of the world. Yes? No's. Yeah, that's the implication there. You were the only one.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, go ahead.
My reasoning on that is the human god mm-hmm. is the metaphor for industrialization.
Mm-hmm.
And is not as human, more inhuman, and has taken the build technology is everything, sort of mechanical bits, as opposed to a pure human form.
That's kind of what I was thinking that he meant.
like sort of a natural native god, and not human.
Yeah. Well, whenever he says human, I think that's actually what he means.
Technological.
Yeah, yeah, you've got something more of a god of advancements. I think that that's actually what he was kind of getting at whenever he initially brought up the idea. Next.
I'm not sure if this is actually implied or not, but...
Please.
A lot of settings have more or less silent gods with very few, for lack of a better word, prophets.
Yep.
So much. I like the idea of a very active god in the role gods in the
I,
role
I think
of
it's
the world.
A compelling idea. Do we have active gods? Yes. No. Active gods, it is. Active gods. They or at least in the sense that they interact with the populace in some way.
Yeah.
They're verifiable.
Yeah.
Okay. Other setting idea.
Well, I know we've talked about these whole things coming from the mind. Would that mean we have a certain psychic element to it? Maybe certain people that are good at banishing the psychic apparitions? Or
psychics? Yes? No? I think that that's pretty implied. It's good. Back there?
To go on what she said, so, like, psychologists working you through your problems helps you vanish.
Therapy to banish demons. Yes? No?
I like that.
That's a good one. Freud monster killer.
One more idea. Jenna, back there, right.
Well, I mean, you could do something like that, but also with the dualism too, like, you know, the natives having, like, you know, the talismans that protect you from, like, you know, the, and then, like, the science, like, more psychological science that helps you too.
So, basically, your defense in one side is animus, talismans and tablets and shit like that, and on the other hand, you literally have sort of science.
Yeah.
One side gets science as a defense, one side gets magic as a defense. Yes? No. We're good. I think that's pretty good. We've got a pretty solid sort of stew of ideas here. The last thing that I'm going to go over, though, is... how do we want to represent this mechanically? Like, how do we want to address these ideas? What type of game do we want to throw together? You have a thought?
Well, if we go back to the understanding by having a mental health and a physical health mechanic, and we say that the holistic traditions of the native people are better at treating the whole person, whereas the scientific ones are focused very much on the physical, like tied into that whole thing. There was no psychology, there was animism. There was really no thought of psychological health until very recently, whereas in most traditions, traditional cultures, it's hugely important, it's more important than physical health. Physical health derives from your spiritual and mental well-being.
So what we're really talking about here is we're talking about trying to represent the duality of the setting with the mechanics. I like that. Do I have any naysayers here? Because I see a lot of nodding and stuff. Okay. I think that's important. I think that's going to be one of the big elements of it. Another thought?
Perhaps to track the mental health, to be more specific, is, say, a corruption, like, sort of meter. Like, I'm this addicted, this corrupted to the intoxicating power of this resource. And that would manifest more monsters.
I'm going to throw a pitch. I think that, and, you know, shoot me down, feel free. I would love to see the character sheet and the health track in that regards be a phrenology map.
Yeah.
Wouldn't that be cool?
Yes.
Do we have any naysayers?
Naysayers.
Not so much naysayers. I'm having a hard time picturing phrenology map.
Oh, phrenology map. The heads that they used in the Victorian era that have the regions where you can, like, you know, mess with them and change people's behaviors theoretically, but then you actually just were stabbing people in the brain.
The bumps in your head told you how far you were.
Yes. Which is totally logical.
Going off of this so far, I really want to see dreams as a conduit of some kind. Getting into mental health, getting into mind delving.
Oh, yeah, psychology's all about it. So.
Dreams, like a focus on that as a form of examining the unconscious mind.
I definitely think that needs a mechanical place. Jason?
I think that there needs to be a way of tracking and interacting with if people, characters are making white choices, gray choices, or black choices on certain issues.
Okay.
Which culture are they favoring? Are they trying to find a middle ground?
I can actually see that as issues? Literally being a part of our phrenology map. I think that you can have regions, because regions dictate like
areas of behavior, and you could literally have a continuum on each track of behavior. Like your aggression could be positive or negative, or black and white, as the case may be. So I definitely think that we're good on that.
Just a clarifying question about this. Is this like I can independently boost my imperialist and native stats, or is there, it's like a fixed meter, and after a while I need to choose every time it clicks back and forth along a line?
Okay, so my idea, my postulate would be that you have an upper limit. Hypothetical numbers here, but say you can have a total of 10 points between imperialist and animist.
Between both of them.
Yeah, and you start with maybe two or three or whatever, and you get to choose. But basically, as you get to a certain point, you'll have to decrease the other. But you can still raise them together. It's just that there's a certain point where you hit a critical mass, and you have to give up some animus to be more imperialist. Yes or no? Yes? No. We're good. Back in the back?
How about to go with the addiction and the penalty for that? You reach a certain point, you black out, something happens not under your control that you did. So you're responsible for something that's not under your control.
That is good. We're kind of pulling back a little bit more into like setting, which... While I would love to talk to the limited time, we're going to try to move a little bit more into the mechanics. Next one, Conley.
Yeah. I was going to say maybe having some sort of, because we're talking about fears being a thing, that's something that is required of a character. That when you like make your character, you have to spend so many points in fear, so many points in maybe some sort of mental strength, and then they have to balance out. Maybe you can buy more. Get more strikes, we have to get more fears.
Oh, cool. I like that idea. Next to you?
Well, I was thinking of how we were going to make the addiction affect the characters as well on this map.
Good question, and I think we're going to hit that in just a second. Do you have an idea?
No, I just wanted to bring it up.
It's a good question. It's a good question. I think we'll hit it in just a second.
Okay. Riffing off your phrenology method, maybe what you do is you actually choose when you're choosing what option you're playing, what character originally comes from.
Mm-hmm.
You choose either having a chronology map and an old-fashioned Grey's Anatomy biology map for the imperialist culture, or you have a more, like a single representation that represents both your physical health and your mental health.
Like a holistic approach.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so certain kinds of mental imbalance are associated with disorders of certain parts of the body, which is often is a common thing.
Like an acupuncture map.
Something like that, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Okay, so what I would do in that case, because I think that that's a cool approach, because that actually addresses what we were talking about. I think that what we could do is we could literally take the same ideas and the same traits and remap them.
Exactly.
And just have a different visual representation. So, like, if the phrenology map has 10 spots on it, we just make sure that the other map has 10 spots on it. Because it's a very abstract thing that we're talking about here, but I think that that's awesome. Actually, continue.
The thing about that is that divorces fit there's this strict sort of mind body divorce on the one side,
mm-hmm.
whereas in the other there's a link between
a link. Yeah. You would have the phrenology map and the body, but the point being more that they're equal and opposite.
Not quite. Well, where I was going with that was that
okay.
Playing into that common. Mean of if you're affected, I don't know, in your left pancreas,
mm-hmm.
then you're more likely to be, well, you know, the idea of being splenetic or phlegmatic, that whole thing of what happens in your body is, and what happens in your mind are indistinguishable.
Mm-hmm.
So you make a choice when you're creating the character.
Oh, yeah. No, I know what you mean, and my point is more that in a mechanical sense, your characters would have effectively similar traits,
yeah,
but just mapped in a different way.
But are they hard linked?
I would say that the two are, while there is an equality in the system, they would represent different things. It's like how in a lot of games you will use the same system for multiple things. We would be using the same system to address opposite concerns. Bob?
Well, on that point though, I think that starts to get into an area where I've seen a lot of problems in RPG design, in that if you link character personality and behavior to actual mechanical effects, you run into the problem where, either you risk forcing your players to try and behave in ways they do not want to behave, or else you are trying to track exactly how their personality is going to affect the game world, and that's very subjective.
It is. Games are very subjective.
It's the lawful paladin problem.
Yes. I could go on for days about that specific topic. that's a hard one. A hard one to address. I think that
in this case, not to cop out, but in order to avoid the long, long discussion that that would cause, I think that what we're really doing here, though, is that we are addressing a strong continuum that is encouraged in every character, and not, like, nobody is encouraged to play a polar. You would have a mechanical incentive to do either side or the center to, like, sort of balance what you are doing. We could go into it all day, but I think that that would, again, take a little bit of time. I totally understand what you're saying. One more thought here.
I was just considering how to work out mutation, and it kind of made me think of the kind of like a fate system where the higher your power is, the lower your will is, and that maybe if there's a conflict involving the gods that you're getting your power from, the lower your will is, you only have so many points to use against them. So if you want to go against them in an issue, you have to spend some of these points, and if you're low enough, you don't have points to spend, and that's how your character kind of gets controlled. The DM would say, okay, well, you know, your god's on this side of this issue, so you have to go with this side or spend a point.
Yeah, and that also that goes well with the sort of the continuums that we've been talking about, where you have one side and you have the other, and you sort of have to balance them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think that would probably be the same way. In order to keep it unilateral, to sort of keep the system simple, I think that doing a continuum is definitely a good idea there. Bob?
I just wanted to say, I wouldn't be a fan of that system, because I don't think it's a good idea to force players to make certain choices.
What choices?
Like, to say to a player, oh, well, you have to side with your god on this because you're low on points, even if the player wants to do something else.
I can see that. I think... And correct me if I'm wrong, I don't know that it's as much forcing as it is encouraging certain things, like giving certain sticks and certain carrots. Like, you wouldn't be forcing. Like, you wouldn't really be...
It would just be something like, you'd have to spend a point to get over it, or if you do go along with your god, you get more points. I mean, like, the face dummy, it does compel them, but if you're going to use the addiction system, then you have to have some sort of compulsion.
An addiction is a compulsion.
Yes. So you have to have a compel in there, and they take that note. They can always make a character that doesn't use magic at all, and then they don't have that problem. But if they make a character with magic, they recognize that if they use too much of it, they risk losing control of their...
So what you're doing is you're not actually compelling. What you're actually doing is prohibiting. You are telling them if they use the magic, there will ultimately be a punishment for it.
Kind of. I mean, that's how our system is working. It's a resource. It's like a drug. If you use the drug, yes, you'll get a stronger character, but you risk losing your character overall. The price.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what it is. It's a consequence. It's not a compulsion. It's a consequence. It's just a consequence in the form of a compulsion. Okay. Next step, so we don't get too far off, is do we want to represent it? Do we want to represent it with a more traditional system, or do we want to use a resource system? Because I hear resource coming up a lot here. Do we want to use spent points and stuff primarily?
To go back to as you were saying about the making a choice from one god or the other,
mm-hmm.
and a resource and the consequence system. What I was thinking is you use up so much till you reach a bar, which a consequence happens. And the consequence goes from one side or the other, and that's the resources. That it's an internal resource. There's only so much you can use before a consequence happens. That
it's a balancing resource as opposed to a spending and gaining resource.
And it might almost be refreshing as well. Like, you know, you can only use the power so much in a certain period of time.
There's a lot of with that sort of thing. There's a lot of complication that we could talk about. We could get into, but that's I don't know that we need to get into that level of complexity with it. I think what we're really talking about is something whether or not you are spending it or you are balancing it.
Well, you spend it up to a point of the consequence, and then you start over.
Yeah. Ultimately, though, it's a limitless resource. Because you're spending up to a point of a consequence, and then it refreshes, basically. So it's effectively a limitless resource.
Well, the price keeps going up.
Okay, I can sort of see that.
The consequence could be a limit.
Yeah, your limit is consequence and not a limited economy.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what I mean by a limitless resource. I'm sorry. Another thought.
Perhaps since it is an addiction, it is a compulsion, and we could have a balancing act. You have to sate your addiction while preventing the consequence. You have a consequence on both ends. I didn't get any of my magic stuff today. Now I'm tweaking. Or I overdosed.
Woohoo!
Sort of.
Yeah, consequences on both ends there.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thought?
This may be a bit out of the scope of this discussion.
We'll see.
But at the same time, looking at these systems, I'm not sure. Are we sure players are going to want to do this? Are we sure this addiction system is something that people will voluntarily role-play into?
It's a good question. That's one of those things that you would jot down on the paper and you would try it out. You'd see how it works. You would toy with it. You have a thought?
It kind of reminds me of the old Dark Sun kind of thing. You
can
only use it so much. If you use it too much, bad things happen. You can play Dark Zone.
Yeah, yeah. It's a little like that.
It's got that same feel.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, this is a lot more kind and gentle than Don't Rest Your Head.
Yeah, and people love it. Yeah, so it depends on the players. Again, it's one of those things you would really want to play with. You would really want to try it. We have a skeleton. We really have a basic sort of grasp of what this game is. Do we have a statement of expression or a title? It is still pretty abstract, but I think that we could flesh it out with a little bit of vision and filtering. Any thoughts? It's a challenging one.
Translators?
That's a neat layered one. I kind of like that. Other thoughts?
Between worlds?
We seem to have gotten a bit scattered with a few topics. So are we still trying to integrate both the ley line transportation resource and the idea of the belief in gods warring against each other?
Yeah, I think that they're both definitely integrated into this. I think that sort of gods on one side, gods on the other side, ley lines in the center, and they're sort of compelling.
They're drawing from the transportation and ley line network.
Yeah. Hmm. Yeah, it seems like they want the resource, or at least they want the people to have the resource. Again, we're pretty abstract here, and there's nothing wrong with that because we're real preliminary in the scope of the game. So.
Between gods and men,
it's a pretty good one. That might be taken, but no, it's still a good one. It's still a good one. Thought.
Is a statement like this, is this for internal use only, or should it be, like, super sweet and polished?
No, it doesn't need to be. Like, there's a difference between this and an elevator pitch, for example.
Okay.
My first game, actually, the elevator pitch ended up basically being the tagline, but my initial tagline that helped me develop the game was Ghost Stories and Space Stations. And every time it came down to a question, I went with Ghost Stories and Space Stations.
Okay.
So it can be compatible, but it does not have to be.
Just call it conflict.
Conflict. I don't know that that communicates very well, though.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you don't.
What game doesn't have it?
Huh?
What game does that not apply to?
True. You have to get the
one. Internal mediation.
Internal mediation. That's actually that would be a good one for a sort of declarative idea. That would be a good base, a good jumping off point.
Which god will you choose?
I like that.
Psychoside magic.
Balancing gods.
I work for two magic drug dealers and I hate it.
Yes? No?
I like that.
I think that that's a good sort of framework to work from. And so that's what we have. We have a skeleton. We have an idea. And if you are filtering this down and you are trying to make it into a more perfect game, you have more to work with there. What he's just said, that actually communicates a whole bunch. It will help you overcome a lot of conflicts. It'll help you tackle a lot of questions that you will have in your development process. So,
There we go. I think we've got a skeleton there. What time is it?
It is about 1:30.
Okay. I have some extra time, so I'm going to, if anyone has any questions or anything, I would love to answer them. But I will, for the rest of the weekend, I'm going to be at my booth at 1356. You should all come over, say hi, talk to us about our games and stuff, and, you know, hang out.